It's the Drone Strike edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Humanist Report, a bit from Morgenthaler, Hacking HIV, Game Dethroned, and Drone War, Good or Bad. Let's begin episode 213.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan.
Yes.
Do you know, we had syphilis, that was a horrible thing, destroyed sex for a whole generation.
Yes.
Then you had AIDS, which was a horrible strike against, sex in the 80s and all that. And now apparently, oral sex is going to give you cancer.
According to who?
Douglas. Michael Douglas.
Really?
And at first glance, did you actually read the article?
Well, I looked at the headline and laughed and then moved on.
Well, it actually turns out there's something there. Apparently, if you read the article, he claims, and probably with some credibility, that he got human papillomavirus, which has been known to cause cervical cancer and, among other things, cancer of the anus. It's actually one of the leading causes of that. I'm sure this is according to Wiki, so bear in mind. But about 1 to 5% of mouth or oral cancers are traceable back to the HPV or homo. So he was actually kind of saying this is a public service announcement because he says, hey, listen, I did oral sex and I got this and it's rare that it happens and I'm going to keep doing this, but you should be aware. And in the United States, it has an added connotation because there's now a vaccine for the human papillomavirus that is opposed by a number of conservatives because they think it's going to lead to promiscuity. And it's maybe one of his way of saying, of going out there and saying, hey, listen, maybe we should do this. And it was a great stroke for the Canadian medical system because he'd been suffering from some sort of throat ailment for a while and he went to all his doctors. But in a visit to Montreal, he went to a Canadian doctor and a Canadian doctor said, holy crap, you got a golf ball in the back of your throat. And he got cured.
Well, you mentioned the HPV vaccine. That's also opposed here in Canada as well. It's quite a big story in Alberta where I think a lot of the opposition is localized, again, because of this notion that somehow preventing sort of genital cancer in women or young girls is going to lead to promiscuity. I'm not quite sure how that adds up.
Well, the idea is that we can't get them to stop doing it, one, because, everyone wants to do it. But if we have the threat of literal death, that might help restrict them. And the idea is that you're willing to risk your child's health and life just to promote this one particular moral stance that in itself is questionable by even people who are religious. It's horrific. It's like sitting there saying, we're going to ban the use of penicillin to fight syphilis because if you got syphilis, you were obviously a bad person in the first place.
Right.
But, I made a shout out there to Canada's healthcare system and some of the great things Canada's healthcare system does. And we had a talk with Ian Bushfield of the BC Humanist Association about such things. And let's go with that interview now. Hello and welcome back, listeners. Today we have a reoccurring segment, Humanist Report, with Ian Bushfield, who is here holding two hats. One is the BC Humanist Association Executive Director, and the other is, well, just plain Ian. Hello, Ian, and welcome back.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me.
Lots is happening in the humanist world. First, we should talk about the atheist church. We talked on our show about the growing movement of the Sunday service in the UK and how they've sort of welcomed the title of atheist churches. I've been reading lately, and apparently this is like a global movement now that's taking off everywhere. I understand the BC Humanists, prior to this, have had, you know, their own sort of regular Sunday meeting. First, what's happening there, and why do you have one?
Yeah, so we found a lot of our members just really want a community. They want somewhere they can come, hear interesting topics, and meet some people who are like-minded. It happened to be that most people who are non-religious happen to be free on Sunday morning, and we found a good venue that we can get on a recurring schedule. So we have a meeting every week on Sunday morning. Now, we don't call it church, but those who are happy to in places like Calgary
welcome
and
back.
London.
Joining us in our Radio Freethinker virtual studios is Ian Bushfield, president of the BC Humanist Association, for another Humanist Report. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Don. How are you doing?
Not too bad. As a number of our listeners heard, Dr. Henry Morgenthaler died last week. What a number of our listeners may not have known is that Morgenthaler was also a founding member of the Humanist Association of Canada and served as its president from 1968 to 1999, when he retired or was promoted to honorary president. Ian, what can you tell me about the man, his role in Canadian history, and his place at the foundation of the humanist movement in Canada?
Henry Morgenthaler was a Polish man who was in Europe during the Holocaust and World War II. He was a Jewish Pole. He was rounded up into a ghetto at first when he was a child and then was actually put in concentration camps. So this is sort of the background that he grew up with. You know, he survived the Dachau concentration camp. Eventually, he managed to emigrate to Canada and became a Canadian citizen in Montreal. There, I think he started getting involved in the Humanist Fellowship of Montreal. I'm not sure whether he was involved in founding it or got into it very early, but he was one of those sort of founders of the movement. He started a medical practice while he was in Montreal, and it seems like throughout his career, his focus was always on sexual health. He performed some of the first vasectomies in Canada and quickly realized that abortion needed to be legal. He looked at the status and it was completely illegal when he first got here, and he went as a representative from Humanist Canada before the Parliament. It's something we don't do often enough anymore. So he was always sort of that pioneer willing to step up for his beliefs. He went before Parliament and argued that the abortion law should be repealed and that women should be able to access choice. He made this presentation and then started getting feedback from women saying, we need abortions now, and can you do them? And he said, well, I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to go to jail. It's risky. But, you know, he kept getting calls and he kept getting letters and people just coming to him saying they needed it. And eventually he realized the only way to get this law to change was for him to take it on himself.
Well, one of the things that I just interrupted to put a bit of context to all this, that the Canadian law itself had actually evolved from the outright banning to where hospitals could set up what they call therapeutic councils, essentially, where if a woman could sort of present her case that she needed to have an abortion done, and then it could be done. But in reality, the way the law had actually worked out was that maybe one in three hospitals would have these councils. Even when they did have this this committee set up, it was basically either a show trial sort of thing, because the people who would be on there could be things like priests and that, who just always denied, and there was no way to appeal this. So Morgenthaler at this time was feeling a lot of pressure from just women who were, the only option they had was to go to your famous, you know, back alley abortionist, where you were literally taking your life in your own hands.
Yeah, I mean, he started performing abortions in 1968, and then the next year, I believe it was Trudeau, introduced that therapeutic abortion committee panel. And as you said, it's a panel of men sitting behind the curtains deciding whether or not women get to have their choice. It's not really a free choice at that point. So he decided that this was an unjust situation, and he would just do it the way he felt was appropriate. Performing abortions in a private clinic in Quebec. Very quickly, he was arrested and charged with breaking the law, performing abortions without the proper committees. What was fascinating was that every time he went before a jury, which I think over his life was four or five times, the jury always found him not guilty. All the evidence was clear. people knew he was performing abortions, but the jury had basically just decided the law was unjust. And this is something juries can still do, but they can't be told that they're allowed to do anymore.
Well, the technical term is jury nullification.
Exactly. And it's a very important concept that Morgenthaler used throughout his career and his activism. But what was most surprising is repeatedly after juries would nullify him and find or acquit him and find him not guilty, the appeal courts would then turn around and say, well, the jury's wrong, he should go to jail anyway.
And actually, on that note, at the Quebec Court of Appeal, sort of like it was the first and only time they really seemed to have nullified a jury decision and then caused a reverse, so he was guilty. I mean, appeals courts are supposed to sit there and say, well, listen, the law wasn't done properly and you can have a retrial. But they went to the literally unprecedented move of actually appealing his decision to become a conviction.
Yeah, and so at that point he went to jail and he appealed it to the Supreme Court. But at that point we didn't have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, so he had no real justification for why the law was unjust. It was just sort of personal conviction. So he spent time in jail. They actually turned down his paroles too and kept him in. It seemed like the government of Quebec at the time was really bent on prosecuting him and put him in solitary confinement and made sure he was locked away for good.
From what I understand, the Minister of Justice at that time in Quebec did actually make it sort of a personal vendetta to get him.
And you can imagine, Quebec's a very Catholic province, and depending on who was in government, it might have been a very strong religious almost motivation to keep him out, and you know, the Catholic Church has never been pro-choice, so.
True.
Following that, I guess, he was eventually able to get out of jail, and he started performing abortions again. But by this point, they'd brought in, well, first, I guess we should talk about Pierre Trudeau brought in the Morgenthaler Amendment to the Criminal Code, which recognized that that jury nullification shouldn't be overturned by appeals courts. I think that's something that's really important to remember, that, you know, our justice system's a little more robust because of the work Morgenthaler did and the fights he undertook. Next, we have the Parti Québécois taking power in Quebec in the 70s, and Quebec sort of goes through the silent revolution where the Catholic Church loses its power, and we sort of switch from this pro-choice or this pro-life government of the Catholics to the sort of Quebec culture and maybe push the priests out of office. And then Morgenthaler starts getting his freedoms, and because the Parti Québécois saw how many times he'd been acquitted, they decided the abortion law couldn't be upheld in Quebec, so they decided to just stop arresting people for it, who were doctors, which is a big shift. So now we have in the province of Quebec, abortions can be effectively performed by a doctor, and no one will go to jail for it.
So essentially, he sort of won the battle in Quebec, and he'd done it, ironically enough, by using the justice system sort of against the law itself, by getting his acquittals. It sort of became one of his strategies to actually try and get arrested so it can go to court and be acquitted. And this was a tactic that he took from Quebec and he spread across the country.
Exactly. He knew that just sort of pushing for legislative change wasn't going to happen because they found it too controversial and no one really wanted to bring it up in Parliament, I guess, for fear of a religious backlash, much like we have today. So he fought it through the courts. And with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms coming in the 80s, he was able to start going into Ontario and Manitoba and getting arrested and basically aimed for the Supreme Court of Canada and said, this law is unjust. And he won. In a very strong decision, the justices of the Supreme Court ruled that Canada's ban on abortions fully violated women's life, liberty, and security of their person.
I like one of the readings, Chief Justice Brian Dickerson said that, quote, forcing a woman by threat of criminal sanctions to carry a fetus to term unless she meets certain criteria unrelated to her own priorities and aspirations is a profound interference with a woman's body and thus a violation of her security of persons, which I guess just, so that really kind of put an end to the debate.
Absolutely. And it wasn't just Brian Dickerson's one statement. We had, it was a, what was it? It was a five justices supported him and one or two opposed, but those five justices wrote three different legal precedents of why abortion law should be struck down, basically covering all of the grounds. There's multiple reasons there haven't really been any abortion laws written since, but one of the big ones is that it's really hard to try to come up with a law that would still fit within the precedent set by the Supreme Court in 1988.
And I think one of the great, and I'm going to say advances, that Canada's approach to this has done, at least for the moment, is that essentially what the courts have said is that this is a medical decision between a patient and their doctor, and that's where it should be set kept.
Absolutely. It's for the same reason we don't, you know, ask the law, or we don't have laws requiring doctors to, you know, get permission to have an appendectomy. That's a decision between a person and their doctor. Abortion falls under the same procedure at this point. What's important to remember is Henry Morgenthaler didn't stop in 1988 with the Supreme Court. He realized that striking down the law was the first step. Then he had to make sure that the clinics would open and could continue and would get funding. So he started basically the next day. You know, that day he won in court in 1988 was the happiest day of his life, but it wasn't the end of his work. From there, he started going across the country and opening clinics in every province that he could and fighting any time that an anti-abortion law was passed. And he worked to bring abortion services to most of the provinces in Canada.
Which actually shows another enlightened sort of view of this. Because right now in the United States, where abortion is legal, but what the people who are against it, the anti-choice movement, are essentially making it impossible for women to access an abortion by shutting down all the abortion clinics in this state, this other state. And Morgenthaler seems to have been sort of thinking one step ahead by saying, well, not only is it important that women have this right, but they also be able to exercise this right by having a handy clinic.
Exactly. I mean, the only place he hasn't been successful so far was in Prince Edward Island, where they still don't have a clinic yet, and it's unclear whether or not, I guess the only way a woman can get an abortion in PEI is to ask for permission from the healthcare system there to go to the mainland, and then there's a whole bunch of barriers in the way, so it's still an access issue, and it's an access issue in a lot of rural places in Canada.
So he's kind of sussed out, you know, his stance on abortion and the work he's done that, and he's received, I believe, a Order of Canada for what he's done is sort of to help promote healthcare for women. What about the humanist part of it? His movement is his ability to help forward the humanist agenda.
Absolutely. I found it was his commitment to humanism and that idea that, you know, there's not a God telling us what to do, so we should figure out how to live ourselves, that sort of motivated him in every step of the way. Came to the conclusion that women were equal to men and so should have the right to make healthcare decisions for themselves, and I think that's what drove him so hard. We almost lack that kind of hero today who's willing to go as far as being jailed for their commitment to human rights or humanism in Canada right now, but hopefully we'll see more people at least take inspiration from him and use that to go forward.
Well, I note that he was one of the people who signed the Humanist Manifesto in 1973, along with Paul Kurtz and a few others. And one of the op-quoted lines from that is that no deity will save us, we must save ourselves. And it looks like that he's really, at least in his one particular sphere, taken that on board and made a tremendous difference to the women and Canadians in general.
Yeah, I think he should serve as an inspiration to us all for that commitment and that perseverance to your cause. Obviously, he figured out how he wanted to put his humanism into action, and it's important for us to all figure out how we can best contribute to making the world a better place, because it's not just going to happen by itself. He definitely serves as an inspiration to myself, even though I'd never had the chance to meet him in person. Collecting stories from the BC Humanist members of people who did get the chance to meet him, and I'm hearing all kinds of good stories and interesting perspectives. You know, everyone sort of had a little touch on him. One thing you do read in his biographies is that he wasn't a perfect person. You know, he does admit to being a womanizer, and he was divorced for his first wife, probably for that reason. But I don't think that takes away from the accomplishments he did do and the achievements he made for women and humanism in Canada.
Excellent, excellent. So, Ian, on maybe a different note, just to again to keep in touch with the BC Humanist Association, is there anything coming up in the humanist calendar that might be interesting or a topic that you'd like to talk about quickly?
Well, on our Sunday meeting coming up this week, we have a couple researchers from the University of Toronto who are looking into the intersection of religion and politics in Canada. And they're very interested in the poll results that we had and that I discussed with you earlier on the show. And so they're going to come to our meeting, talk a little bit about their research onto, you know, how does religion and non-religion influence the Canadian political structure. And then they're going to have a discussion to hear from our members and the attendees on what we think. And so it's a good chance to get our voices in there. They self-admit that this is a very understudied part of Canadian politics, and they're hoping to fill that void, so it should be very interesting.
Sounds very, very exciting. Again, thank you, Ian, for joining us and our audience at Radio Free Thinker. Any last words?
You can find out more about our group at bchumanist.ca.
Thank you very much. You have a good day, and we'll be back right after this break.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
For the past 7 years, Sled Island has delivered a hot, fresh, and saucy music and arts festival in Calgary, Alberta. In 2013, it's saucier than ever. From June 19th to 22nd, independent musical acts, visual artists, filmmakers, and comedians, including the CITR Showcase featuring White Lung, will frolic your amusement at over 30 venues. For more information on schedules, venues, ticket purchases, and more, visit www.sledisland.com. Sled Island is proudly sponsored by CITR.
And we're back here on Radio Freethinker. So a few minor technical hiccups early there.
We did a funny. So I apologize to our listening audience. I can't say we're inexperienced, Ethan. We had a brain fart where we tried to do the pre-recorded show, and the machine didn't work the way we thought it did, and we thought we were playing the right segment, and we were actually playing an old segment, and then we finally got the right segment going. Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, Ian. God, why do I keep saying that? Thank you, Ian, for showing up for the show. We appreciate your little bit about obituaries. And let's go on to something much more lighthearted, like, I don't know, AIDS.
Yeah, thanks, Don. So we actually have a bit of a pretty cool story here using technology to understand HIV/AIDS. So scientists have been focusing on their treatments with AIDS, focusing on the viral casing or the capsids. These capsids lay between the virus's spherical outer coat, a 0.1 micron diameter lipid-based layer known as the viral envelope, and it's got a bullet-shaped inner coat known as the viral cone that contains the strands of HIV RNA. These capsids comprise about 2,000 copies of the viral protein P24, arranged in a sort of lattice structure. The capsid is responsible for protecting the RNA load, disabling the host's immune system, and then delivering the RNA into the new cells.
We have a nice document our listening audience can watch, right? No, they can't see that. It was a very good description, Ethan.
Thank you. There'll be a test later. Now, since HIV is very good at mutating to avoid drugs and antibodies, targeting the sort of physical makeup of the virus is a really good way to sort of sidestep its tendency to sort of evolve itself out of problems. Now, to quote Dr. Peijing Zhang, project lead and associate professor in structural biology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, the capsid is critically important for HIV replication. So knowing its structure in detail could lead us to new drugs that can treat or prevent the infection. The capsid has to remain intact to protect the HIV genome and get it in the human cell. But once inside, it has to come apart and release its contents so that the virus can replicate. Developing drugs that cause the capsid to dysfunction by preventing its assembly or disassembly might stop the virus from reproducing. Now, the difficult aspect of this is the precise structure, how the thousands of copies of P24 actually mesh together. Well, we don't know how that works. So the capsid's, you know, relatively large size and non-symmetrical shape, protein structure has stumped researchers, baffled them, you might say. And so what they decided to do is basically give this all this information to a supercomputer and have it do all the work.
Cool.
Yeah. So enter Blue Waters, a $108 million supercomputer at the University of Illinois. The computer has 49,000 AMD CPUs and can handle 1 quadrillion floating point operations every second.
Wow.
That's almost as powerful as my computer at home.
Yes. And your new phone.
Yeah, exactly. So the team fed in the data, and the results were recently published in Nature. So the HIV capsid requires 216 protein hexagons and 12 protein pentagons to operate, arranged in exactly as the predicted model would be. So they were right with their research. The new discovery reveals a versatile protein in P24. The protein itself is identical, whether it's shaped into a pentagon or a hexagon, and only attachment sizes between P24 and proteins vary between shapes.
So depending on where they connect is determines whether they go for a pentagon versus hexagon.
Yeah, and that sort of explains why it's so, you know, so good at what it does. It's really an amazing virus. It's too bad it's killing us. This breakthrough illustrates precisely how the capsid works and how scientists can best attack it or disrupt its ability to replicate. So theoretically, this is like, finding a padlock or a key to HIV. And by, you know, messing around with it, there's a really good chance that this could be sort of an unconventional way of stopping HIV in its tracks.
Yes, and actually, you know, there's a lot of other weird things that come up with this too, because as we understand how the particular molecule works, HIV is also one of those, how do I put this, noteworthy viruses for doing genetic modification. So if you sit there and you've got a genetic disease, and your disease happens to be like in something that is like your immune system, it's very hard to get a target to change that. And if you can understand how HIV works and you're able to manipulate it easily, then this opens up a whole new vector for trying to create new medicines for people in the future. Although, of course, then you become a genetically modified person and you may not be allowed to go in a farmer's field or anything because you may poison the crop or something.
Yeah, possibly. But it is really interesting because a lot of the research towards developing like vaccines and or just treatment in general have usually focused on sort of the drug aspect side. And I remember actually seeing, I think recently at our Skeptic Camp, we had speakers talking about this very particular strategy of dealing with HIV, of kind of focusing on the sort of Achilles heels of the virus, of attacking it in a unconventional way. And I think that's really fascinating. I mean, it really goes to show you how far our technology has taken us.
Well, I also like the idea, too, is the idea of, you know, the supercomputer. We were talking before the show about something called big data, which is going to be a topic in an upcoming show. But where we have at the moment the ability to capture lots and lots and lots of data, but we don't have the computer processing power to actually filter and use that data. And this is an instance where they had the information and now the technology in order to actually do something, to actually understand what's going on, is beginning to catch up with what we know and become useful.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
It is Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Let me know where he's from.
From parts unknown.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it. Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
The Parts Unknown!
Break your fingers!
The H.R. Macmillan Space Center Women in Science series continues on Thursday, May 9th. With biologist and engineer Maxine Chin, finding your path to engineering and science from taxidermy to robots. If you or someone you know is exploring a career in science and engineering, be at the Macmillan Space Center Thursday, May 9th at 7 p.m. Admission by donation. For details, visit spacecenter.ca.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker on CITR. So, Don, drones.
Aren't those male bumblebees go around and go...
Yes, that's right, they are. That's very good. Actually, there's been a lot of talk, discussion, debate, if you will, on drones, unmanned combat robots. I thought it would be a good idea to take a skeptical look at some of the issues surrounding this controversial military weapon.
And to say that there's been a little bit of discussion about this is kind of like saying that there's been a little bit of CO2 put into the atmosphere, or there's a little bit of water in the oceans. It's a pretty hot topic.
Yeah. What he's alluding to there is there's been a lot of discussion.
Yes.
A lot of debate. So what is a drone, first of all? So a drone, as defined by Wikipedia, is an unmanned aerial vehicle, a UAV, or an unmanned combat aerial vehicle, a UMAV. So an aircraft or like a tank or a robot without a human pilot on board, its flight is either controlled remotely by computers or remotely via a human somewhere or under the remote control of some other, you know, satellite or something like that.
One of the things I thought was funny when I was doing some research for this is when you see the M, you probably were thinking military. UMAV,
mm-hmm.
But in the American military nomenclature, they have R for reconnaissance and M for multi-purpose.
Hmm.
It's not actually that, because, of course, one of the purposes is still reconnaissance, and the other one is to put a cap in someone's butt.
Well, that's interesting. Mm. Well, so now that we understand what a drone is, what do they do on the battlefield? Basically, it's a question of what do you need? Right now, drones can do everything from defuse roadside bombs. They can do aerial reconnaissance. They can act like smart missiles. They're, you know, the sort of hunter-killer drone type things. With the other ever-changing nature of war these days, drones can be programmed or catered to the needs of the soldiers controlling them. Certain tasks will naturally lead to drones being developed. Now, there can be a bit of a lag time until that niche is found where a drone is needed. You know, it has to be discovered by a soldier, usually tragically. But once it is, and the drone can be developed and tested, and it can be inputted into that task. So you have like bomb detecting drones. And there was a really interesting TED talk about this, where the speaker was discussing how a soldier was killed at a bomb. And it turns out that the soldier was actually a drone. And it was implemented because this is an incredibly dangerous job.
Well, and it's funny, too, because you mentioned the technology, you know, finding the niche. But actually, some of these things are quite interesting, because the bomb detecting one that you mentioned was originally intended for bomb detection. But now they're actually used for search and rescue. They're actually used, you know, when you have those checkpoints and someone comes up and they inspect. Well, instead of having someone look underneath the truck and all that, they actually send this little guy and he puts his little camera underneath the truck to do the inspections directly. Because as you point out, you never know what you're going to see underneath there. And the further away you can have bomb from person, the better we tend to look at that.
So what does this mean for the battlefield? Now that we have drones able to do dangerous tasks like disarm bombs or fly reconnaissance or even, you know, drop a bomb on an enemy, doesn't this vastly improve things for human soldiers? As the saying goes, you don't need to write a letter to a robot's mother telling her the robot has died in service. But there are several issues that have arisen with drones in the military, and I want to talk about some of them and then provide some skeptical commentary. But before we go, you know, much further into this, I think it is important to acknowledge from the beginning that we know war sucks. We're obviously not going to dispute the fact that it would be much better if we didn't have war at all. But given that it's here, let's go with it and try to find the best way of getting through with the minimal amount of casualties.
Well, one minor point there, though, just so we can help, you know, clarify this, because you know, we're going to mention things like rule of war and that sort of thing. What actually qualifies now as a war? I mean, that's one of the things that really makes this a complicated issue, is the idea of war itself is morphing. But perhaps that's something we put aside for the moment.
Yeah, well, again, that's a tricky one. So let's go into what I consider the human connection. So drones, for the most part, right now, aren't autonomous. They need a human pilot or a controller. Now, what this means is that there is a human somewhere who is picking the target or defusing the bomb or whatever. They're either in a bunker somewhere or maybe they're 20 yards back with a remote control. In this sense, using a drone is not so different from firing a sniper rifle. But what if the person controlling the drone isn't a soldier? What if it's a scientist employed by, say, a technology company that has a military contract? Soldiers are, quote, expected to adhere to, quote, rules of war. Now, civilians don't really have these same expectations. So, for example, if you have a scientist flying a drone and it's supposed to blow up a bunker and misses and blows up a school, for a soldier, that's an instance of friendly fire. For a scientist, it's kind of mass murder. So how do we deal with these complications? The other factor is when in battle, a soldier has control of where and when he or she fires their weapon. Whatever comes with that decision, the soldier has to live with, or in some cases, die with. So to be poetic about it, the soldier has to look down the barrel of their gun into the eyes of the person they're about to shoot and make a decision. Now, a drone can't really do this. I mean, right now, at least. Probably never, probably. So any mistake made by the soldier could land them in front of a military or a human rights or a Geneva Convention court. You know, if they miss, if they disobey orders, if they accidentally shoot the wrong person, they face real consequences. Now, a drone doesn't really face any consequences other than being decommissioned, and it's not really self-aware, so it's not a big problem for it.
You're a biologist. Just because they're not a biological entity, robots can maybe at some point gain self-awareness, and they could have a conscience, and they may look down that barrel and have an oil tear.
Yeah, maybe, possibly. So these are some of the concerns that I've encountered while doing a bit of research on this, and perhaps there's definitely more. But to keep to be short here, let's go on to some commentary that I have about these particular points. And I don't want to write off any of this as meaningless, so I'll provide some alternative views here. Let's consider the scientist controlling the drone. It seems like a pretty real scenario. The obvious solution would be to sort of redraw the lines of combatants. If you're controlling a military weapon, you are now a, quote, combatant. If non-military people are in direct control of drones, either via a third party or as a technology firm or some kind, their actions are directing military weaponry, and by all reasonable accounts, they're now part of the battle. So I don't see too many hurdles with basically just expanding our concept of that to make them equally as culpable for their actions on the battlefield as a soldier would be.
In many ways, this has already been done, because one of the things that was noteworthy in the Iraqi conflict was the Americans outsourcing to essentially mercenary contractors who were sort of working for the government, but they weren't actually part of the military.
Right.
And as you point out, by and large, they were considered to be deemed as if they were soldiers, both as far as things like immunity for what, I don't want to say war crimes, but because that's not the right word, but for things that they had done that if you were a civilian, you would be charged for.
Right.
But there was still a lot of gray area in there, but probably not an insurmountable one.
I don't think so. I think that with the right amount of legislation and careful scrutiny, we could probably come up with a solution for that problem. Now, what about making soldiers impersonal killers with the use of drones? Well, in actuality, I think that's what soldiers are right now without drones. The notion of sort of personal investment through looking down your barrel at an enemy seems kind of like a romantic notion of wars long past. For a very long time now, soldiers have been using high-tech machines to wage war. So everything from sniper rifles to jets to stealth bombers to submarines, tanks, rockets, they all allow soldiers to kill from a distance and never personally see their enemy. And what I think is interesting about this hasn't had a big impact on the psyche of soldiers. We're still seeing lots of rates of PTSD or soldiers having intense personal issues with their duties coming back from war and having difficulties. So I don't necessarily think that because a soldier can press a button and blow up a building, they're losing any more humanity than they would have lost by pressing a button to send a missile to blow up a building.
Well, what about the idea of the gamification of warfare? I mean, the fact that, unlike in previous generations, you know, even though you might have a pilot who could fly over and, as you say, is as detached as possible, but there's a certain sense of realism to what they're doing.
Mm.
Whereas, because right now, I mean, everyone plays war games, and in many ways, the way these drones and other remote-operated vehicles are used, it's really emulating the video game environment, that this sort of dehumanizes in a way that we haven't seen before in the past.
I don't know if it does. I mean, I think that I'm reminded of news reports of the first time they used the bomb on Japan. And I remember listening to the interviews by the pilots and how they like pressed a button and there goes the bomb. It sounded to me like as close to a video game as it could possibly have been for them then. I just find it hard to believe that the added situation of the drone doing the dirty work versus pressing a button to order an airstrike is all that different for the psychology of a soldier.
Well, what about then the idea that it just becomes easier? I mean, one of the things that, you know, drones have done, so even if ethically it's not that much difference, it's they have thousands and thousands of drones, and they have people in Texas who are doing it, so there's no longer sort of a cost to flying all these missions, which just makes it easier to kill more people in more places than it was before. And that, and again, in a sense, sort of dehumanizes what's going on, because what was like the atomic bomb was like a landmark decision. Now, being killed by a drone is like getting on the bus here. I mean, it's not that uncommon.
Mm-hmm. Again, though, but I think that a lot of the tools at the disposal of the soldier has actually gotten more precise than it's gotten more willy-nilly, for example. You look at the use of napalm in the Vietnam War, of just like blanketing a jungle with poisonous gas. Or another good example would be in World War One, when they would just lob shells. And just be like, I hope it hits them this time. If not, oh well, you know. Whereas now it's sort of like they say, okay, here's our target. Let's launch the drone. There's like an 85% chance it'll wipe out that target and that target alone. There's, you know, a 15% chance it's going to hit someone else. But it seems to me that it's gotten a lot more precise as weaponry has developed. And I think that for that extent, they're actually an advantage over traditional weaponry. I think that there's more. I'd be more worried about soldiers walking around with like AK-47s.
See, I don't know if I would agree with you quite on that point. I mean, I do agree with the idea that they have the appearance of being more precise. And you're right. Between bombing a village with an airplane versus a quote unquote surgical strike that may or may not get the guy you're after and maybe the family next door, it seems like that's sort of a trade off that seems worth. But at the same time, though, because you've just said, you know, hey, they're a lot more accurate, so I'm much more willing to use them, then I might not have used a similar type thing, like sending in a SEAL team to go in to take out this person. That fact that it seems so much easier. We had the same thing with tasers. I mean, when the tasers originally came to police forces, the idea was instead of shooting someone, you would use the taser, but you'd use it as if it was a gun, very rarely. But now it's just like first thing you do is you walk up and you taser them. And these drone strikes are sort of the same way. I mean, in Pakistan alone, which is not at war with anybody, the United States has killed over 2,000 people, right? Mm. In Yemen, there are hundreds of people who have died. And again, they're ostensibly, there's no... And because it has made it easy to sort of go in and get out, even if you say it's surgical in the sense that less people, innocent people are dying, there's much more of it happening, which kind of counterbalances the argument.
Well, I mean, like I said, war is always going to suck, right? Like, that's the problem is, I mean, we're talking about two alternatives that suck. You have SEALs go in and shoot a bunch of people, or you have a drone go in and kill a bunch of people. Neither one of those situations is good. We have to pick the one that's going to cause the least amount of harm. And, I mean, maybe not in every circumstance it's going to be a drone. And many it's probably going to be like a surgical strike by Marines or whatever. But I don't think it's necessarily not going to be the drone.
Well, okay, but right now we're sort of at the point where we have semi-autonomous robots, for lack of a better word. Robots are so much more cooler to say than drone. But
it is kind of.
You know, like at the moment now, it is still a human sort of making that decision to kill. But, I mean, in the near future, in fact, the technology exists now. It's just not deployed to have a completely autonomous kind of idea of robot. What about the whole idea that we're creating, you know, Skynet or you know, that the problem with all this isn't the ethical issues. It's the technological issues.
Yeah, and I was kind of looking into that as well. There seems to be sort of a lot of advanced technophobia. And don't get me wrong, like, drones are definitely advanced tech. They can do some pretty scary things, and they're getting more advanced as time goes on. But there's a lot of talk about that technology is just going to keep advancing, and we're going to eventually have drones that are like the Terminator or Skynet or something. And I'm actually very skeptical of that notion. I don't actually think that the drone technology is going to exponentially, constantly advance to the point where we're going to have robots walking around with machine guns. And I think that you know, if you look at some of the articles and the things that I was reading about fears of future tech, there were an awful lot of words like possibly and might and could potentially. And I get being cautious, But we also have to remember that being the cautionary principle does play into it. And every time you see a line in one of these articles that says, well, it sounds like science fiction, so-and-so is taking it seriously, you could easily substitute that with, you know, while the concern for genetically modified food could mutate into monsters may sound like science fiction, ... or while the concern that vaccines could cause unintended risk is generally unsupported by science, but ...
Actually, in many ways, that's the genetically modified crop one is much more realistic, only because they're self-replicating. I mean, so you know, plants self-replicate. At the moment, we don't have machines that are self-replicating machines. So that whole evolution sort of argument is a little flat at the moment because it still requires us to actually make the thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the other interesting the component to that is people don't really talk about sort of the maintenance of these drones. Like, I would assume that they're machines, so they're going to need fuel, they're going to need repairs, they're going to need whatever the things machines need. And it's hard to sort of imagine that you would have like an army of drones try to, you know, take over the government or something, and then they all shut down because they get rusty. You know, like there's more to it than that, right? They're not just autonomous robots walking around killing things.
Although that would make for the lamest ending to a science fiction novel.
It would really suck, yeah. The other thing that, I mean, I don't want to get too sidetracked into kind of like criticizing the whole singularity thing, but I think that there actually is something to be said. There is a lot of criticism, and legitimate criticism, that technology will not necessarily exponentially advance in every field. I mean, cell phones and tablets are one thing, but, you know, how many radical revolutions have there been in like air conditioning and coffee makers?
No, let me tell you what has happened in Q-tip technology in the last few years. No, although actually you're right. I'm not surprised that you don't get like a thermometer built into a Q-tip just to take your body temperature.
That would actually be a good idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I mean, the fears of future tech. Again, how much should we be afraid of them? I think it's hard to say. I think that we're not going to necessarily see. We're going to go from aerial strike drones to the Terminator the way that it's being projected. Now, does that mean that we should be totally fearless about what we put on the battlefield? Absolutely not. I mean, some people have said that, you know, we're on a path here to creating our own, you know, nuclear winter or whatever. But this process began when the first guy stuck a pointy rock at the end of a pointy stick. We've been on this path for a long time.
True, but that being said, and actually I think what we have here is we have the risk versus value. Because, I mean, you know, there are going to be autonomous weapons put out there, and they are going to have friendly fire or kill civilians through some either defect or something like that. But as you say, it's not quite the doom and gloom. But to correct you, there is one area. Samsung is developing a totally autonomous Sentry that's going to be deployed along between North Korea and South Korea, the no man's land between there. And in an odd sort of way, that actually kind of works, because literally the only people who should be there are either going to be wearing some form of RF tags or are legitimate targets. So it sort of simplifies the math about, you know, if I have an autonomous drone protecting, I don't know, my embassy in downtown New York, well, it also has to worry about civilians that are not enemies, but, you know, you don't want to accidentally kill some guy who stumbles across the threshold or something.
Well, that's it, right? You have to program these drones to recognize what is a target, what is not a target. There's still so much human input that goes into these things that it's kind of hard to say that they're totally autonomous.
Well, and again, it's also, you know, this specific location. In fact, another place where we've had autonomous robots that shoot to kill have been in, I think it's called Guard or Guardian. And it's used on ships. And essentially, you say, hey, we're under attack. And anything that comes within the airspace of that ship, these remote turrets go and they just fire a hail of bullets. And that's been around since the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to quote political scientist Joshua Goldstein in his... Well, he was quoted in Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels. Quote, where an army previously would have blasted into a militant's hideout, killing and displacing civilians by the tens of thousands as it went, and then ultimately reducing whole towns and villages to rubble with inaccurate artillery and aerial bombing in order to get at a few enemy fighters, now a drone flies in and lets fly a single missile against a single house where militants are gathered. Yes, sometimes such attacks hit the wrong house. But by any historical comparison, the rate of civilian deaths has fallen dramatically. And I think it's really interesting how drones have captured so much attention, which I think is actually a good thing, because it shows two things that are really fascinating. One, due to the global village, technology, social media, whatever, we are far less tolerant of collateral damage during war than ever before in our history. And two, our fear of technology is outpacing our technology in some respects. Now, that's good or bad, depending on who you ask. But healthy skepticism is good.
True. I think what you're pointing to here, though, and this is going to go back to the it's easy sort of argument.
Mm.
And where the real debate is, because as you point out, I mean, technically, ethically, whether someone has been taken out by a drone or automated sentry or what have you is not really any different than if it was done by a person in the flesh sort of thing. But because it's become so much simpler, one of the quotes there that you just said, you know, about how it rarely seems to miss people. Well, we have to remember, and this is where a big debate comes with drones, is miss who? So you have someone who may be involved in something that might be criminal in a certain context, and you're essentially assassinating them for that. And, you know, it's the idea that there's no legal framework for using this new sort of tool that has come on to the field. I mean, in the past, as you say, there are rules of warfare. And at the moment, the rules of warfare haven't quite learned to address themselves with this new level of technology. One of the interesting things about the United States context is Obama's Kill Tuesday, where he has a list of people who are targets for drone assassinations. And, you know, there was a lot of challenge about how that comes about. And they use some very interesting terminology where there has to be an imminent threat. But an imminent threat is now defined as any time perhaps in the future.
Yeah.
Right? And they have to have due process. But that due process, it just means that there is a process that they go through, and not as we normally think due process, it has to go to a judge and there has to be actually some form of legal justification for doing this. And the idea is that you've given these new toys to a bunch of people who at the moment have no legal framework or no accountability to use them. So it's not so much that the technology in and of itself is frightening or scary. It's how we are using it and how it's being incorporated into the modern concept of life and warfare that is causing a lot of people to be upset by this.
Well, I mean, the concept of life and warfare is already so sketchy. I mean, it's so new, relatively speaking, for human civilization. It's actually, I was just kind of thinking as you were saying that, Don, that it's very, very, very similar to GMO. Because we think of the GMO's foods as like these weird frankenfruits or something like that. But it's not the fruit. It's the how they're implemented. We're concerned about things like Monsanto and how they're regulated and how they're made. Our moral skepticism should be directed at the policymakers and the people who use these drones, not necessarily the technology itself. Not that we shouldn't at some point say, hey, maybe it's not a good idea to put nuclear weapons on that satellite, but we should probably say, that drone that can kill people at, like, you know, six towns over, maybe we should have better rules for how we use that.
Well, you know, it's one of the great ironies, because one of the things that's been put up as a big criticism about Obama is the fact that he's accelerated and amplified the sort of use of drones as a way to eliminate America's enemies. And part of that is the technology, but another part of it is when they went to the old traditional way of trying to go in there, grabbing the people and putting them in jail, which we called extraordinary rendition back in the day, right? And that's where Guantanamo Bay or Gitmo has come up, is that, you know, in order to stop doing Gitmo, you know, doing it the way we have a legal framework for, however poorly designed it may be, it's just become simpler just to kill them, and you don't have to worry about having these people in an indefinite detention. So in a way, in order to cure one ill, which was this extraordinary rendition, they have created a new ill, which is extraordinary elimination.
Yeah, yeah. And that's sort of one of the themes that I kept thinking about, was that because the framework of the conundrum, this concept of war, is so not optimal, it's really hard to have practical solutions that don't also sound crappy.
Well, and that goes in with the other area, which I kind of alluded to sort of, I think, at the beginning, is, again, it's not the technology that's really the big issue, although, again, it allows for certain activities. But you mentioned war, and you say, well, war is always – well, I mean, war on terrorism, like a war on drugs. I mean, in a really real way, that has no meaning, right? Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, I have a war on fear, so therefore I can kill anyone or anything that might instill fear in people. And that's, again, one of the issues that comes in with this. Because these are used, quote-unquote, in the war on terror, people don't have a problem with the drones. They have a problem with the idea of war on terror and that it can never end, and it's an excuse to doing everything.
Well, yeah, and that's the other elephant in the room, is we're not even talking about war, state-on-state war. We're talking about state-on-concept war, which just further clouds the issue. It would just be so much easier if all the terrorists could just get together and declare themselves a state. Then we could solve this problem.
Exactly. Or yeah. Or we just ended the war on terror.
That, too, would work. Yeah.
And means. The war on drugs. And but we should have the war on poverty. It's amazing. The only war that we've given up in that terms is the war on poverty. It's like, yeah, screw it. People can starve to death.
Well, yeah.
Don't you dare get high while you're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we are running out of time here on Radio Free Thinkers, so we should probably go to our skeptical highlights. Now, I have two.
I'm going to go for my two first, because I have a highlight and a low light.
Okay.
So I'll start off on the highlight. June 8th, which I believe is Saturday.
That's right.
Is World Ocean Days. So come on out and help celebrate World Ocean Days at the Vancouver Aquarium, where the World Wildlife Federation. I hate that wrestling took over WWF. Well, they got rid of it. Anyhow, they're having a family day where you can come out and you get, there are games, there's going to be big talks, there's going to be a birthday cake and the whole nine yards. It's being held at the Vancouver Aquarium. Again, it's starting 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The admission is regular admission to go into the aquarium. So fun times to be had by all. On a low note.
Hmm.
There is a talk going on in Burnaby. Actually, I guess there's two of them, two different days. Again, June 8th and another one on June 9th. Vaccines, synergistic toxicity, demilitarization, and the blood-brain barrier impacts. Apparently, an independent vaccine researcher, which basically means quack, fraud, or worse, is giving a PowerPoint presentation. PowerPoint. It's an anti-vax thing, and they're going to talk about how children have been injured by that. It's being held in Burnaby Kingsway at some wellness center. Don't go. If you want to protest, I would welcome you to go and protest. For everyone who's worried about Big Pharma, I'll point out that it's $20 a ticket to get into the door, so I'm sure there's no profit motive for this person to do this particular thing. Boo, hiss, don't go, pick it. Be warned.
Fair enough. My skeptical highlights this week include the CFI Book Club, which is meeting Saturday, June 8th at 1 p.m. at the Grinding Gallery Coffee Bar over on Main Street. And they are reading Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Orskes and Eric Conway. It's a fantastic book about the merchants of doubt who have cast doubt over climate change as well as things like the tobacco lobby. So fascinating study of those two pseudosciences. I encourage you to go check it out. My second skeptical highlight is happening on Saturday, June 22nd, and it is a CFI family barbecue. So this is one of CFI Vancouver's first family-friendly events. It's happening at Memorial South Park. There'll be socializing, barbecue, vegetarian, and meat lovers in a family-friendly environment. Lots of open fields and playgrounds nearby. And it's all free, so just go on by around 1 o'clock and hang out with some cool skeptics.
So when you said you're serving vegetarian and meat lovers, is that what's on the table, or is that who will be at the table? As in, you know, would you
we're
like
serving vegetarians.
Would you like a vegetarian burger? As in, we got these vegetarian guys, we chopped them up, and we made a burger out of them, or?
No, we're actually going to serve the vegetarians meat lovers.
Oh.
Yeah. As a way of, like, spinning things around.
Yeah, that's paradoxical.
Yeah. Well, it'll be lots of fun. Just one note, please do not bring any alcohol to the event. It is a family-friendly social gathering. And again, Saturday, June 22nd. Well, Don, we're out of time.
I think I'm going to say eyes open, minds on.
And I'm going to say thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
Explore the arts this winter at League Square Community Arts Fair.
Got a 38 special in a 45 frame. I ain't gonna miss cause I've got that aim. I'm gonna ride. Bell, railroad bell. Well, railroad bell rolling down a hill. Lighting seagulls with a $10 bill. I'm gonna ride. Before I die, I'm gonna build a railroad for the bums to ride. I'm gonna ride that bad railroad bit.
Wish.